Hello there. Today is Monday, October 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump plans to visit the hurricane-devastated U.S. territory of Puerto Rico Tuesday.
I hope that he has a chance to go into the areas that are most devastated. And I hope he gets a chance to really look at people, look at people's faces.
Trump tweets the nation's top diplomat not to bother trying to talk to North Korea. Facebook's CEO is using a Jewish holiday of atonement to ask for forgiveness for the social media site's failures. Also ahead, a new movie about surviving a plane crash. This is today's International Edition. President Trump on Sunday dedicated the President's Cup golf trophy to the people of Puerto Rico, Texas, and Florida, still recovering from recent hurricane devastation.
On behalf of all of the people of Texas and all of the people of, if you look today and you see what's happening, how horrible it is, but we have it under really great control, Puerto Rico and the people of Florida who have really suffered over this last short period of time with the hurricanes, I want to just remember them, and we're going to dedicate this trophy to all of those people that went through so much that we love, a part of our great state, really a part of our great nation.
Earlier Sunday, Trump dismissed those he calls politically motivated ingrates who've questioned his administration's commitment to rebuilding Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Trump followed up after Twitter comments made by San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz, who has been critical of the Trump administration's hurricane efforts. Asked by ABC's This Week what she hopes to come out of the president's visit to the island Tuesday, Cruz, who is living in a shelter with her family, says her only goal is saving lives.
I hope that he has a chance to go into the areas that are most devastated. And I hope he gets a chance to really look at people, look at people's faces, see them drinking from a creek, and know that we may be small, but we are great in valor.
Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rossello, said Sunday that the number of Puerto Ricans in shelters following Hurricane Maria has decreased significantly and more U.S. Defense Department personnel are on the ground.
Our priorities at this juncture keep being food delivery, delivery of gas, making sure that the hospitals are working, making sure we can get more hospitals online, that they get their diesel and their fuel. Establishing as best mechanism for robust communication, whether it be telecoms or otherwise, and the air traffic control so that we can get more assets here in Puerto Rico.
Rossello noted that some recovery has been made. He said 51 of the island's 60 hospitals are now open, and airports and seaports are receiving shipments. But almost a week and a half after Hurricane Maria devastated the island, about half of its 3.4 million residents still lack access to clean drinking water. VOA's Celia Mendoza is in Puerto Rico.
This is Ocean Park. It's still flooded. Some of the areas close to the ocean. This gas station is completely destroyed and people is not able to come back to their homes. One of the biggest problems right here is the fact that this water is actually sewer water. And it is a problem because residents that try to come back to their homes won't be able to do it, especially because we're talking about the possibility of diseases, cholera, Zika, all these problems that could spark up because of this situation. I'm Celia Mendoza from San Juan, Puerto Rico for VOA News.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A Somali man has been arrested in the suspected Canada lone wolf attack. Protesters march through Washington streets for racial justice. Militant groups in Pakistan are rebranding themselves as political parties. And amid setbacks, President Trump eagerly pushes tax reform. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump said he told his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, he's wasting his time trying to negotiate with North Korea's leader. On his Twitter account, the president wrote, "Save your energy, Rex. We will do what has to be done," referring to North Korea's Kim Jong-un as Little Rocket Man. Trump was in Beijing on, or Tillerson, excuse me, Tillerson was in Beijing on Saturday seeking China's cooperation on a maximum pressure campaign against North Korea when he revealed the United States had opened a direct channel of communication with Pyongyang and was investigating whether the government of Kim Jong-un was interested in pursuing talks to give up its nuclear weapons. Saturday, the State Department said North Korea has shown no interest in pursuing talks on its nuclear and missile programs. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Evans Revere, who was formerly one of the U.S. State Department's top Asia experts.
The secretary is on the record as having said a number of times that the door is open to dialogue. The preference is to resolve all of this via dialogue. Other members of the administration have said the same thing. And yet here we have the president coming out saying, well, it's not worth your time. He's not saying don't do it. He's saying it's not worth your time, which is, I think there's a distinction to be made there. And I think it's his way of conveying to the North Koreans that, serious people in the government are interested in resolving this peacefully. And I've said myself that I'd like to resolve this through dialogue as well. But quite frankly, if you North Koreans are not prepared to respond positively to overtures and gestures like this, and then I have another mechanism for resolving this. I mean, that's my translation of what the president just did.
Do you think there is any chance whatsoever that this works?
I think the chances are slim. I mean, if the goal is to prod the North Koreans into accepting an offer that's out there, I don't know that this gambit, if that's the right word, is going to bring that result about. I think the core problem here, sort of stepping back and looking at the overall dynamic in the relationship right now, is that it's possible to have a conversation with the North Koreans, but it's not going to be the conversation that the United States wants to have. The United States wants to have a conversation about getting rid of their nuclear weapons program and getting rid of their ballistic missile program. That's not a subject that the North Koreans want to discuss. And the North Koreans, on their part, are prepared to have a conversation about some things that the United States doesn't want to talk about. The North Koreans want to talk about total removal of sanctions and the end of our military exercises in return for probably nothing. That's not a conversation Washington wants to have. So we're stuck.
Is there any room for compromise?
Well, I think there's room to have a conversation, but a conversation that needs to be so general and so without conditions that it might allow the two parties in the room to sit down and for each side to raise its own issues. That may be the only mechanism, I think, that gets the two parties in the room at the same time. And it might lead to something, but more likely than not, it won't, because the United States is insisting legitimately on denuclearization. Meanwhile, the North Koreans are insisting on no exercises, no sanctions, peace treaty, etc.
Even if there is any room for negotiations and any room for movement as far as positions are concerned, here you have the Secretary of State making these comments in China, and then you have the President of the United States using his tweet board on the other side, and it doesn't seem like the U.S. is moving in any way on either side.
Well, it's not the ideal way to conduct diplomacy, to put it politely. I'd say it's a terrible way to conduct diplomacy. When the Secretary of State is basically out on a limb in Beijing, he's saying what normally people would regard as the right thing about channels being open and using the connections that we have to Pyongyang to convey a message of diplomacy and dialogue. And the President of the United States comes out literally within hours and says, forget about it, don't waste your time. That's not a good way to go about sending a consistent, clear, and universally supported message to the North Koreans. It raises questions, certainly on their part, about U.S. seriousness, but we're also seeing in reactions from the international community that it's raised questions among U.S. partners around the world. You know, why are you doing this? A number of people have come out and said that over the last several hours. This is not the way to do diplomacy.
What would you do if you were Rex Tillerson? Would you keep on your job? What would you do?
Well, If I am right in my theory that this is a good cop, bad cop gambit, then I suspect the secretary will grit his teeth and press on. But if he has actually been undercut by the president of the United States, if he, in all sincerity, talked about these channels in Beijing and talked to the Chinese about U.S. preparedness to engage in dialogue, and the president pulled the rug out from under him, that really undercuts his credibility internationally, and he has to think very clearly about whether he's prepared to continue working under those circumstances. So it all depends on whether this is something that has been scripted in advance or if it's something spontaneous and the rug has been pulled out from him. I feel sorry for the secretary.
That's VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Evans Revere, former State Department advisor. Well, turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, the big stories that people are still talking about are Facebook and Twitter's involvement with these Russian ads and Russian campaigns to try to influence U.S. opinion during the 2016 presidential election. As we talked about late last week, Twitter was up on Capitol Hill testifying in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to have Facebook, Twitter, and Google testifying up there on November 1st. Mm-hmm. But after that testimony that Twitter gave last week, they're getting some reaction from Capitol Hill. Virginia Senator Mark Warner, who sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee, said that Twitter's explanations were deeply disappointing. And he said that Twitter's efforts to combat fake information was inadequate on almost every level. So getting some very stark and harsh words against Twitter from some members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. It's a little bit of a preview of what we should expect in about a month's time when they go up there on November 1st. They're going to have to really explain what happened, and they're really going to have to give some answers. So far, the senators on Capitol Hill have not been satisfied with what they have had to say. And I don't think the American people are going to be satisfied, quite frankly, either. I think they want information about why this happened, how they're going to combat it, and how they're going to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Okay. Anything else going on?
Yeah, well, along the same lines, Mark Zuckerberg issuing a new statement on his personal Facebook page addressing some of the problems that Facebook has had with these Russian ads. Over this weekend was the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, the Day of mm-hmm. Atonement, mm-hmm. and Mark Zuckerberg, being Jewish, writes on his Facebook page that he asks for forgiveness for all of the ways that his work was used to divide people rather than bring people together. He says he's working to do better. May we all be better in the year ahead, and may you all be inscribed in the Book of Life, is what he says on his Facebook page. So definitely making acknowledgement that Facebook has been used to divide people rather than unite them. This is a very general statement, so he's not necessarily referring specifically to these Russian ads, although that's what's been in the news lately, mm-hmm. Referring, I'm sure, to other instances where Facebook has been rather divisive. For instance, these National Football League protests where people have been divided, and just the general divisiveness of politics on Facebook. But this is an indication from Mark Zuckerberg that hopefully in the next 12 months he's going to be focusing more on bringing people together on Facebook and trying to combat some of that divisiveness.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
B VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, the financial tech industry is considered a disruptor of sorts, upending traditional forms of financing, such as banks. And while financial tech companies are growing and raising lots of money and revenue, the industry hasn't been particularly welcoming to women. In the U.S., only 8% of director-level positions in financial tech are held by women. And across the board, the industry is dominated by men at all levels. But one fintech company, the Los Angeles-based FastPay, is really bucking that trend as women have climbed to the highest ranks in the company. Joining us now are three women with FastPay: Elise Lin, head of front-end development and quality engineering; Michelle Fiordaliso, head of marketing; and Christine Kucherer, GM of platform growth. Let's start with you, Christine. You're in charge of driving the growth, and you interact with lots of clients in fields that have long been dominated by men. So why did you choose this path?
So I have previously been in financial services, and I really enjoy this field just because it's really intellectually stimulating. I've been in a variety of fields: consumer, B2B, wide range of stuff, internet, entertainment type stuff, but I really enjoy financial services because I feel like my brain's getting a workout every day.
So do you think that there's a unique skill set that women can bring to the position that you're in that could set you up potentially for greater success?
Well, I think anybody coming into a financial services company has to come in with strategy, quantitative skills, analysis, so on and so forth. But I think I bring a feeling of empathy and collaboration in my day-to-day interactions. And you don't always see that in financial services. So I do think that's a little bit of a difference that I might bring.
Okay. And Elise, we're going to turn to you now. So you've got 17 years of experience in the tech industry. Again, as we've been talking about, a pretty male-dominated industry. Why do you think that women haven't found tech companies to be welcoming?
I mean, we all know gender stereotypes start very early. That plays a big part of it. But the male-dominated aspect of tech and engineering professions, it's just a big challenge for women to feel comfortable in that kind of environment. Some women do, but I think majority of women are more comfortable in a little bit more of a collaborative environment. I mean, I know personally a lot of women who have advanced very quickly in technical roles and the tech sector, and I think they've tended to do so, but using more sort of masculine traits to their advantage. And I think that's kind of a shame. I even count myself among those who've kind of been excluded from that. And, you know, even thought, you know what, I'm probably not bound for leadership myself because I'm too quiet. And I really like when everybody gets along. I don't really like making waves.
And can you share how you personally paved your own way through the field, in the field?
So, again, I really can't conform to what I saw around me as kind of being successful. I was just like, you know what, I have to just do me. And I've always just loved what I do. Ever since I was a kid, I really loved building things and just reverse engineering. So for those who are motivated to solve technical problems and just kind of build and do, I would just say you have to focus on yourself. Don't be distracted by all those sort of competitive things that you see going on around you, and try and find organizations that can support you. And there are a lot of them. And in my situation, I was really fortunate to have supportive managers. And I have to say, at FastPay, this was kind of the first time I'd ever experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that more people in positions of leadership and authority can empower people like me who might not really have looked like that traditional leader that's very aggressive and dominant.
Right, in a more male-dominant type of environment.
Yeah.
Michelle, as head of marketing, do you find differences in the way that a company with women at the top end of leadership or in top leadership positions operates compared to male-oriented companies?
I definitely do. I mean, I can speak to our company personally because I've been at the company when our leadership positions were mostly filled by men, and now I've sort of witnessed our company transition into a much more balanced executive suite. And I certainly notice a significant difference. I feel like there's an increased sense of collaboration and efficiency, and that has actually been quantifiable. We're kind of working together to propel the company forward much more than we're at odds with each other. And I think that it makes it a much more pleasant environment to work in, and it's actually producing better results.
Is it quantifiable?
It is. We've shown record growth in the past year. And, you know, maybe coincidence, but it has matched us having a much more balanced executive suite at our company.
And just for whoever wants to chime in on this one, what advice would you give to young women who want to enter the field of financial tech?
I think historically there's been a misbelief that to succeed in these industries, particularly ones that have been male dominated, like finance and like tech, that women have to behave in stereotypically male ways. And this isn't true. You don't have to contort yourself into what you believe the industry is demanding of you. And so what I would tell women is that, for as pat as it sounds, be yourself.
Well, that was Elise Lin, Michelle Fior DeLiso, and Christine Kucher of FastPay. We appreciate all of you for taking the time to talk to us. Oscar winner Kate Winslet and Golden Globe winner Idris Elba star in a new survival adventure, The Mountain Between Us. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the film tells the story of two people who survive a plane crash but have to braze a frozen wilderness to survive.
So what's the rush?
I'm getting married tomorrow.
Oh, congratulations.
No, it's we're not.
We just met.
So what took you to Idaho?
Medical conference. Are you a journalist?
Mm-hmm.
I would explain the questions.
Kate Winslet plays Alex Martin, a famous photojournalist who is on her way to New York to get married. Idris Elba plays Ben Bass, a neurosurgeon who is trying to get to Baltimore to perform an emergency operation. Their plans and their lives take a very different turn when their chartered plane crashes in a snowstorm in the Rocky Mountains. The pair have to learn to rely on one another if they are to survive. At the Toronto Film Festival, Winslet said that her on-screen relationship with Elba echoed the improvisational way that they decided to play the scenes.
It was amazing for me, actually. I learned quite a lot from Idris in terms of just letting things go and trying something new and being really experimental. And I love doing that anyway, but it's not often that you find another actor who really does consistently do that. That's very much his process.
Much of the movie takes place in snow and ice. Filming was done in Vancouver, British Columbia. And the characters try to navigate their way to civilization. Winslet says that the weather was as much a character in the movie as any of the actors.
You know, we literally wouldn't know what conditions we'd be confronted with every day, and we just have to cope and get on. You know, you can't not do it because there's a blizzard. You know, actually quite the opposite. Hanny would say, get out there, it's amazing. You know, the blizzard is incredible.
Yeah.
Like, okay, running on in there. So I think probably if anything, I discovered that I'm more stoic than I even thought I was in the beginning of stoicness.
Idris Elba says that the film shows how two strong-willed, independent people have to put themselves aside so that both can survive.
Do you know what? I just think we both love doing what we do. That's the number one rule of anything, is just enjoy doing it. If you don't enjoy doing it, don't do it. Number two, I think that we both wanted to make a great film and peel back the onion on the truth. It's a human story between two people, and we both wanted to present a film, especially now in our world, that, you know, love is important, trust is important, and even if you don't know somebody, you can love and trust them, you know?
The Mountain Between Us is directed by Palestinian director Hani Abu Assad and also stars Beau Bridges and Dermot Mulroney. It is rated PG-13 for a scene of sexuality, peril, injury images, and some brief, strong language. It opens in U.S. theaters October 6th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have announced the fourth detection of gravitational waves, which is described as ripples in the fabric of space-time. The gravitational waves were detected by the two Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatories, or LIGO, here in the U.S., and for the first time, the Virgo Interferometer, located near Pisa, Italy. LIGO Virgo officials say the newly detected gravitational waves were observed at 10:31 UTC on August 14th, and like the previous three detections, was produced by the violent merging of two black holes. Before the merger, the black holes, located about 1.8 billion light-years away, had 31 and 25 solar masses. They combined to form one black hole with a mass of 53 of our suns. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Regimes that seek nuclear weapons in the name of enhanced security and prestige are dangerously misguided, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said at a recent UN Security Council meeting on the nonproliferation of weapons of mass destruction. What the pursuit of nuclear weapons in fact represents, he emphasized, is a path to isolation and intense security scrutiny from the global community. A better, proven way to enhance a nation's security and prosperity is to deepen integration with the rest of the world and adhere to international standards and agreements. Secretary Tillerson pointed to the Korean Peninsula as a stark example of these differing paths.
While North Korea has shunned the international community and let its people starve while it relentlessly pursues nuclear weapons, South Korea has opted not to pursue nuclear weapons and is fully engaged with the international community. As a result, South Korea has grown into one of the world's great economic powers with a GDP over 100 times that of its neighbor to the north.
In contrast, North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons is leading to greater isolation, ignominy, and deprivation, Secretary Tillerson declared. Continued threats against the United States and the global community will not create safety for the regime, but will rather stiffen the global community's resolve and commitment to deterring North Korean aggression. Mr. Tillerson said there are also lessons here for Iran, which was on its own pathway to develop nuclear weapons, in violation of its non-proliferation treaty and nuclear safeguards obligations and multiple legally binding UN Security Council resolutions.
Iran seems keen to preserve for itself the option to resume such work in the future, even while sponsoring international terrorism, developing missile systems capabilities of delivering nuclear weapons, and destabilizing its neighbors in a dangerous quest of regional hegemony.
The collective responsibilities of meeting such proliferation challenges will require more from all of us, Secretary Tillerson said, beginning with upholding non-proliferation norms, including the full enforcement of relevant UN Security Council resolutions. But, he added, treaties and resolutions are not enough. Stopping nuclear proliferation also entails exercising other levers of power, whether diplomatic, economic, digital, moral, or if necessary, military. Ultimately, said Secretary Tillerson, we each have a sovereign responsibility to ensure that we keep the world safe from nuclear warfare, the aftermath of which will transgress all borders.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.